For more information on ancient dragon Zen Gate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone.
Welcome.
Good evening.
So a week ago, we began our spring practice period, 2-month practice period, in which we're looking at the teaching stories of Dongtan, the Chinese, 9th century Chinese founder of this tradition, who also is credited with writing the precious Marasamadhi we just chanted. I talked last week about this pivotal story, You Are Not It, It Actually Is You, about non-self, and we'll be going back over that, but I wanted to go back tonight to kind of the first story, major story, about Dongshan and how he came to meet his teacher, who said eventually, just this is it. This is a kind of complicated story, and it deals with a lot of issues, but it really has to do with our relationship to the world, to the things, so-called things around us, to the environment. The way it's phrased at first is a little strange, but the initial question that eventually brought Dongshan to his teacher, his name was Yunyan, had to do with how or whether non-sentient, so-called non-sentient beings express the Dharma. So, to try and make the story somewhat concise, Dongshan went and inquired about this story to one of the great teachers of his time, Guishan, who was founder of one of the other five, so-called five houses of Chan or Chinese Zen, along with Dongshan later on. But anyway, Dongshan... Actually, Dongshan is his name after he became a teacher, but we're calling him Dongshan even before that. When he came to Guishan, and he questioned him about an older story. So, you know, this is a tradition of teaching stories, and a lot often the teaching stories refer to other teaching stories, so it gets a little complicated. But he told a story about the national teacher, Nanyang Huizhong, from the century before, who had maintained that non-sentient beings expounded the Dharma, expressed the Dharma, the teaching, constantly, radiantly, and unceasingly. And in that older story, Huizhong states that all the sages can hear this non-sentient Dharma, this teaching of so-called non-sentient things. And part of what the story is about is what do we mean by sentient and non-sentient? What does it mean to be aware? What is the meaning of consciousness and even intelligence? But the basic story, Huizhong said that yes, all non-sentient beings constantly express and expound the Dharma. Then he said, Huizhong said that fortunately he himself could not hear the non-sentient beings expounding, because otherwise human students could not hear his teaching. So there's a lot of stuff going on here about how the teaching is conveyed, and it's kind of slippery. But then the national teacher, Huizhong, talked about as a source from the scriptures, from the Flower Ornament Sutra, about sentient beings expounding the Dharma, where it says that the earth expounds Dharma, living beings expound it, throughout the three times everything expounds it. So this question has to do with how do we hear the teaching, how do we meet reality as a gift, we could say, from the environment, from the flowers and grasses and trees and all of the things of the world. After Dongshan narrated this story, he asked Guishan to comment, and Guishan simply raised his fly whisk. So this is a teaching staff that they used to use, a fly whisk, you know, in the same way as to represent the teaching authority back in China. Anyway, that's all Guishan did. He just raised his whisk. Dongshan didn't understand, and he asked for further explanation. Guishan proclaimed, "It can never be explained to you by means of one born of mother and father." Isn't there a line in Macbeth sort of like that? Anyway, this citing of non-explanation is important to Dongshan. He talks about this later in terms of his own teacher. Dongshan was puzzled, and finally he suggested that Guishan go and talk to this guy Yunyan, who was not a very well-known teacher, but had studied together with Guishan and under the great teacher Baizhang. Dongshan went to Yunyan and asked the question again. But at this point, some kind of philosophical or historical or theological background is necessary. So this whole idea of the Dharma being available and expressed in the world, you know, by the things of the world, by the flowers and grasses and trees, by the lakes and rivers, but anyway, where does this come from? Well, there's a tradition of this. It goes back to India in some ways. There was a teaching that came from India to China, along with all the other many teachings from India, called Tathagata Garbha, the womb of Buddhas. How this got expressed in China I'm giving the short version, and there's more about this in the Just This Is It book. But in China, this idea became understood as Buddha nature. And the idea of Buddha nature changed. Originally, the idea of Buddha nature was that certain people had Buddha nature. They had this capacity to awaken and become Buddhas. Other people, not so much. No matter how long they practiced, for how many ages, for how many hundreds of thousands of lifetimes, they had no potential to become Buddhas. So, you know, maybe there are people you can think of who you might think might be like that. But anyway, as this teaching of Buddha nature developed in China, even before Chan, before Dongshan, there were a number of important teachers who talked about this. One step was that they came to understand fairly quickly that, according to a sutra translated from Sanskrit, that all sentient beings, without exception, have the Buddha nature. So they came to see that all sentient beings have this quality of this capacity and quality of awakening and of kindness and compassion. But then there developed this kind of discussion in Chinese Buddhism. There's a Tiantai school teacher named John Ron, who's very important, who said that there was this teaching potential for grasses and trees. And in India, and still in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, grasses and trees or plants are insentient. They don't have any capacity for expressing the Buddha teaching. But this shifted in China. There was another teacher from the Madhyamaka or emptiness school that said that if you deny Buddha nature to anything at all, then not only are grasses and trees devoid of Buddha nature, but all living beings are also devoid of Buddha nature. So they started seeing how this capacity and quality of realizing and expressing Buddha's teaching of wisdom and compassion, was a quality of reality itself. Now this is really, you know, this is, for us looking at this in the West, this is really interesting in terms of thinking about our relationship to the environment, that this was established, before, even before the beginnings, or early in the beginnings of Chan. And this goes back to, just to get a little technical, the Huayan school, the flower in the school, cosmology, which had this vision of the world as a luminous ground of interconnectedness and of mutual non-obstruction of particulars, that in which all things shared in expressing this underlying fundamental truth. So this is some of the background. Let's say a little more about this. Zhang Ran, we mentioned, said that the very colors and smells of the world around us constitute the assembly of the Lotus Sutra. They are the immediate and undefiled expressions of Buddhahood. So this developed, maybe this had some connection with the Taoist culture, kind of appreciation of nature. And in Japan, even more so, the sense of nature as the natural order of things having this liberative, illuminating quality. So this is all sort of background to Dongshan. But one part of this is that this, so we started off, the theme for this practice period is the teaching of suchness and the practice of suchness. Suchness being our engagement with reality, with just this, with our experience. So as we've just been sitting, being present, upright, breathing, we, of course, our thoughts rumble around, and you may have been thinking about something you did earlier today, or something you'll do tomorrow, or there's all kinds of ordinary, conventional, phenomenal world kind of thoughts that are part of what's happening when you're sitting on zazen. But also, somewhere there's this sense, and part of the story has to do with senses and how we sense things, of something deeper. So this is not this suchness is not just a human psychological effect or a perceptual effect. It has to do with the very nature of reality. So that's one important point. So this Buddha nature philosophy, there's a lot to it. Partly, this developed in China and happened in India because of Chinese emphasis on human nature and the nature of things, that philosophical context. There's also this really interesting idea of plants having this quality of Buddha nature, and that was not something, again, that was part of Indian Buddhist thought. Actually, it's interesting now in terms of some botanists talking about plant intelligence, in terms of modern science and even plant neurobiology. So they've done experiments. Some of you may know more about this than I do, but they've done experiments that show that plants can make choices. And for example, plants that have vines move towards something that they can grow on. They seem to know. And plants can communicate with other plants in the same species about dangers in the environment. Anyway, so in terms of modern science, there's some interesting correlations here. Anyway, this is all background to this story from Dongshan. This is carried on in Dogen, who we talk about also, who in the 1200s brought this to Japan and talked about how there was this, between people sitting zazen and the environment, there was this mutual incomprehensible guidance and support between people and earth, grasses and trees, and fences and walls and tiles and pebbles. So it's not just so-called natural as opposed to man-made. It's actually part of the nature of reality. That's the kind of underlying theology or philosophy in this story. But going back to the story itself, okay, Wei Shan told Dongshan, go and talk to this guy Yunyan. So he went, and Yunyan lived in these caves along a river. And Dongshan went to him and he told him the previous story. And let me find the story. So, Dongzhan asked Yunyan if non-sentient beings can express the Dharma, and Yunyan said non-sentient beings are able to hear it. The first part was that when he went to ask Dongshan if then Dongshan asked why he could not hear it himself, and Yunyan raised his flags. The same thing that Guishan had done. And you know, they didn't have email to, you know, communicate, they just responded the same way. And Yunyan said, "You can't even hear when I expound the Dharma. How do you expect to hear when a non-sentient being expounds the Dharma?" So this is a sort of a strange, you know, issue for this young monk to be so determined about, and so perplexed about, and going and walking around asking all these Zen teachers. After you know they had this exchange about it, Yunyan also gave us a citation from the sutras. Interestingly, from the Pure Land Sutras. We think of that as separate from Zen, but he quoted the Pure Land Sutras saying, "Water birds, tree groves, all without exception, recite the Buddha's name and recite the Dharma." So this is there are many of the traditional Mahayana sutras that talk this way, about the world itself as being a source of the teaching. So this was an issue that that was important to Dongshan. And he reflected on Yunyan's response, and then he wrote a verse. So we talked about the verse he wrote after hearing his teacher later say, "Yet just this is it," and he wrote this verse that I've talked about that's kind of the core of Dongshan's teaching, "Just don't seek from others or you'll be far estranged from self. Now I go on alone, but everywhere I meet it, it now is me, I now am not it." Talking about this reality of suchness. "One must understand in this way to merge with suchness." That's later on when he leaves Yunyan. This is the story of how he met Yunyan, and he heard this teaching about non-sentient beings, and he said, "How marvelous, how marvelous. The Dharma expounded by non-sentient beings is inconceivable. Listening with your ears, no sound. Hearing with your eyes, you directly understand." So there's a teaching here about how we practice suchness. It's actually a meditation instruction here. And this has to do with both the limitations of our perceptions, but also how we know things. What does it mean even to be a sentient being for each of us on our seat and in our life as when we go out into the world? Part of this thing about hearing with your eyes, you directly understand, you know, it has to do, of course, with the limitations of our human perceptual faculties. And this is, you know, there's lots and lots of these old koans that have to do with this. And a lot of Dogen is talking about how our understanding is limited by our particular human faculties and our, you know, examples I've given that we cannot. If you have ever walked a dog, the dog is aware of this whole other world around us, around him, and around it, and around you, of smell that we don't know. Some of you may have a better sense of smell than me, but still, you don't know what that dog is smelling and knowing about what's been going on right there. And hearing too. Dogs can hear sounds we can't hear. So there's a limit to what we know through our senses. This is an important issue in terms of meditation. Just to be aware of the limitation of our senses and of our spiritual and intellectual so-called senses as well. So this idea of hearing with what Dokshan, so hearing with your eyes, you directly understand. It has to do with what's sometimes called technically synesthesia. To be aware of, just aware of things with different senses. There are lots of examples of this. We might think of this in terms of chanting or mantras, that there's a way in which we hear the teaching through our own voice and through hearing all the voices around us. So how we know things, how things know us is an issue here. There's a story that another story about Yunyan and his Dharma brother are talking about the Bodhisattva of compassion. What does she do with all those hands and eyes? Because sometimes she's depicted with thousands, literally a thousand hands with different tools in them, and with an eye in the palm of each hand. Yunyan and his brother Dao were asking, how does the Bodhisattva use that? And one of them said, it's like reaching back for your pillow in the middle of the night. Which is a wonderful image, just the middle of darkness, the middle of not knowing, just reaching back and arranging your pillow to for more comfort. And in the Book of Serenity case about this, the commentator says, when reaching for a pillow at night, there's an eye in the hand. When eating, there's an eye in the tongue. When recognizing people on hearing them speak, there's an eye in the ears. So it's not sometimes we hear a voice and we recognize it. We don't see the person, but we hear it and we know the person. Once I'm asked, the Buddha spoke of the interchanging functions of the six senses. It's definitely true. There's another example. So in the story about I am not it, it actually is me, and Dongshan's looking at his reflection in the stream that I've talked about, it we'll come back to. I mentioned the French poet Arthur Rimbaud, who said I is an other. So this whole idea of self and how, what is the self's relationship to suchness, to reality, this is not just an intellectual theoretical question. How do we use reality to help relieve suffering? Is in the background of this. This is all about how do we practice for the sake of all beings. But the French poet Arthur Rimbaud also did a study where he said, I invented the colors of the vowels, A black, E white, I red, O blue, U green. I regulated the form and movement of each consonant, and with instinctive rhythms, I prided myself on investigating a poetic language accessible someday to all the senses. So this is just one historical example of this capacity that actually people have. And it's not the way we usually think, and it's not the way we usually see the world, but to be aware of what's around us in a kind of multi-sensory kind of way. So there's a quality of presence that this has to do with. When we're sitting, sometimes I've said, to use as a concentration object your breath, but also sounds, just ambient sound. But also, we're sitting facing the wall. We have our eyes open and we see this. We're not focusing, but we see this wall in front of us. And we're also aware of seeing things with our body. We can see the discomfort in our knee or in our shoulders. We're aware of things in a multi-sensory way. And this helps us to actually be more available to this suchness the practice of suchness that we're talking about. The practitioner's openness to the phenomenal world is not narrowly defined in terms of particular sense medias or from verbal understandings based on hearing the Dharma, but rather awareness of phenomena occurs within a kind of primal wholeness, not separated into visual odor, oral, smell, taste, tactile, or thought. All of the senses might be seen as part of a single instrument for perceiving, engaging, and practicing suchness. So, again, all our senses are limited, but we can be open to just realizing that we know things other than just through our rational system of, you know, linear thought. Dogen said later, having heard the Buddha's teaching is like already seeing the Buddha's body. Furthermore, seeing Buddha's body with your ears, hearing Buddha's preaching with your eyes, and similarly, for all the sense objects, is also like entering and residing in Buddha's home, and entering Buddhahood, and arousing the vow, exactly the same as in the ancient vow, without any difference. So, well, there's a little more from Dogen I could talk about, but he talks about, there's a quote from Dongshan where he says, experiencing the matter, going beyond Buddha, finally capable, we can speak a little. And so Anang asked Dongshan, what is speaking? Dongshan said, at the time of speaking, you do not hear. And the monk then asked, well, Dongshan, do you hear or not? And Dongshan replied, just when I do not speak, then I hear. So we also have this practice of just being silent. And yet at the same time, sometimes we speak a little. And Dogen, commenting on this dialogue, even says, seeing words, we know the person like seeing his face. Three direct pointers are tongue, sharp wit, and writing, fulfilling the way wings naturally appear on the body. Since meeting myself, I deeply respect him, speaking of Dongshan. So, okay, the point of the story, this combination of stories, is how we, and I think this particularly points to meditation, but we can take it beyond that, how we are open to meeting reality in a kind of whole sense way, or beyond our usual idea about, or stories about, how we meet reality and how we share that, and how that helps us to see beyond the limitations we see about all the, you know, all the problems in our life and all the problems in the world. And so there's more to reality than we usually think of. So I'm going to just pause there and see if anybody has any comments or responses or questions or anything else. Okay, sir.
So, you know, as you were speaking, it really occurred to me, you know, why was Dongshan so obsessed with this question?
Yeah, it's a strange kind of question that to him, for him to... Yeah,
it's kind of a doctrinal question, right?
Like, well, it seems like it.
Yeah, it seems like it, but there's something I think that almost all of us probably have some kind of question like that, that is, we're sitting with. You know, in some ways, like, I felt, oh, Dongshan probably already knew the answer on some level.
Yeah.
But needed to...
Well, you heard this.
We're helping him contact that, but it's such a... You know, I think that kind of thing is staying with one's question. And not just going, oh, you did, yeah, teacher, right, okay, cool, you whipped out your whisk, and, you know, I've got it now. You know, like, sometimes that works, but he was like, no, I don't really have it yet, you know? I want to see what somebody else has to say about that. And I really like it very much, and thank you for illuminating it.
Well, yeah, thank you. Yes, it's this sense of... It does show the persistence of Dongshan in taking this question. And, you know, there are lots of different aspects to this question. It seems like it could be just doctrinal, but it's really about how do we hear the world? How do we hear reality? How do we share that? What's going on, you know? What is this reality that, you know, that we're all part of? And part of, you know, and I'll talk about this later in the practice period more, but there's this also this idea in this strain of thought that suchness is not some one single thing. It's actually alive and shifting and dynamic. So the appreciation of So this ultimate reality is totally connected with appreciation of the shifting phenomenal world and the flowers sprouting and falling and so forth. But yeah, this questioning. Actually, I told yesterday we had a Buddhist birthday celebration. Some of you were here, had a bunch of kids here, and I told the story of Dongshan when he was a young boy studying and... I don't know, but I think maybe he was like an orphan who was sent to the monastery. His teacher was studying the Heart Sutra with him, and he got to the part where it said, "No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind." We chant that regularly here, and Dongshan said, "Wait a second! I have eyes, I have ears, I have a nose," and so he didn't just take things, you know, on faith. As we say, he was questioning what's going on here. So thank you. Yeah, big part of the story. Other questions, comments, responses, reflections, please. Laura.
I love thinking about these things we can't really talk about very easily.
Good.
Music is this intangible way of communicating that it's hard to... You can't communicate in words what music communicates in music. But in the last few weeks, WFMT, the Fine Art radio station, had a series where they looked at every single key and said what that key, so like C major would be one key or D minor, you sort of know a major key would be sort of happier than a minor key, but every single one, and there's lots and lots of them, and they talked about all the various things that that key could communicate. And it sort of opened up this entire... set of subtle ways of thinking about, minor would be so different from... Anyway, I guess what it does is just like pry open a box in my head or something. It's like, it's communicating in ways I haven't really thought about or can think about. But Joe probably knows a lot more about this than I do, because he's a professional musician. But anyway...
But yeah, and that's also a little bit like Rimbaud finding colors to sounds.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And all the different languages we might speak or learn.
And they sort of invited you almost like I don't want to reduce it to something silly, but almost like a horoscope, you know, what personality, what keys appeal to you, like what touches your heart. You know? Uh-huh. B-flat major was mine.
Who knows why? Joe, do you have anything to say about that from the music perspective?
No.
I just
wavered.
Yes, Jim?
I was always kind of interested in the music of the spheres. And I don't know what that could possibly be. I don't think it's something that... You know, if you're an astronomer, that you hear it. And I don't know what it is. And then, when I was a little kid, there was a guy on the radio named Arthur Godfrey. Oh. And he had friends that made an album, and that they were musicians. And the name of this album was Light Treat. And they took bird songs and slowed them down and turn them into jazz creations. And especially the one that is especially interesting is the Red-Winged Blackbird, because when you hear it doing its thing, it has many different calls, but the main one that you hear in the spring is... it's obviously going back and forth between at least two tones, and they slowed this down and made something that you could hear, that you could hear slowly. And then there's whale songs, too, that are always, that people who know the whales know which whale is singing that song, because the whale songs change from one generation to the next also.
Yeah, that's fascinating, and it again points to the aspect of this that has to do with how we know and appreciate and even care for our environment, because there's so many things going on that we don't usually see. Barb, do you have any comment on this? Final word?
I'm thinking quite a few things.
Well, give us a little bit, just the last word.
One thing I was thinking about when you were speaking earlier is about non-sentient beings and their capacity for Buddha nature, but and certainly the research that's coming out about especially trees being able to communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
The world, you're familiar with that research, how they can communicate with each other about drought coming and potential, like as you say, environmental dangers, but so be prepared, and it's fascinating what they've been finding that these non-sentient beings can communicate, and so indeed science is supporting this new way of thinking, and so that could lead us to believe that they have Buddha nature indeed. Now I'm trying to think what I was going to say about the other. There was something else I was going to say, but I can't recall right now. So.
Well, maybe it'll come to you all just to respond to what you just said, that part of what this is about is seeing a wider view of reality, which means the natural elements and this idea that plants have intelligence, and sometimes the Cheyenne people say that rocks have consciousness. So what do we mean, what is our usual idea, our human anthropocentric idea of awareness, of communication, of awakening even. So what is the Buddha nature of rocks? And in these old stories, that Dogen's not just talking about grasses and trees, he's talking about fences and walls. How is it that the nature of reality itself has something to offer us and that can inform our sense of how and who we are. So.
Well, I just say something really quickly that you've written about before. I think from a deep ecologist perspective, anyone who's read some of your other work on the poet Gary Snyder, it's almost a natural tendency to see the Buddha nature and the non-sentient in a nature, that sort of biocentric position where we are really one with these other beings, and not just mammals either, but plants and what we typically consider to be non-sentient.
Yeah, and I guess DNA, if you can change a few pieces of the DNA strand and we become and from humans, and it's like a fly or a bumblebee or something.
Or a carrot.
So. Yes, last word then.
So I'm reminded of two famous anthropology stories from an ethnographer who worked with the Ojibwa. And the Ojibwa think that it takes babies a long time to learn human language, but the babies are born speaking the language of dogs and coyotes. And so the babies speak dog and coyote, and then they have to gradually forget dog and coyote to be able to learn human language. And then the other famous story, an ethnographer was speaking with an Ojibwa couple, and there's a big lightning thunder banging outside, and the old man turned to the old woman, old Ojibwa man, to the old woman, and said, "Wow, did you hear what he just said?"
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, and it's interesting how these stories about the foundation of our meditative practice tradition are kind of revoking all of this modern scientific reality. So.